Good evening, everybody. We're going to continue with the teachings on essence of refined gold. So let's begin by cultivating our motivation. And isn't it rather remarkable that we're all still alive this week? Not only last week were we alive and the week before, but also this week. So we've had a whole week to create virtue. How well have we done that? And we have the opportunity tonight to really train the mind in virtue, listening to teachings on these stages of the path to enlightenment. And so let's cultivate our motivation of love and compassion for ourselves and for all beings, and therefore wanting to attain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. But not just seeing enlightenment as some exalted state of pleasure, like heavenly bliss or something, but really seeing enlightenment as freedom from ignorance, anger, and attachment. And so if we really aspire for enlightenment, for liberation, we have to also be willing to give up our anger, to not treasure our anger and hold on to it and insist that we're right and that everybody acknowledges that. And we also have to be willing to give up our attachment to this body, to this ego identity, to everything we usually associate as I and mine. So to attain enlightenment, there has to really be inside of us a willingness to change, and to change on very deep levels. And without that willingness to change, just saying, I want to become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings, doesn't really change much in our mind. There really has to be a receptivity. We have to open our mind, open our heart, be receptive to the teachings, be willing to change. Let's try and cultivate that compassionate willingness to change for the benefit of all beings. I think this willingness to change is important, and yet it's also difficult, isn't it? You know, we were talking, was it last week or the week before, about resistance? You know, the mind that says, well, that's very nice that the Buddha said that, but actually, I think he meant this. You know? And it just so happened that what the Buddha said agrees with my opinion. Just remarkable, isn't it? Yeah. And so to watch how the resistance comes in our mind, you know, how we dig in our heels as, yes, I want enlightenment desperately, but I don't really want to give up some of the things I'm clinging on to. You know? I don't want to give up my chocolate cake. I don't want to give up my boyfriend or girlfriend. I don't want to give up my status in society. I don't want to give up my popularity or the respect other people show me. I don't want to give up my body. What I really want is to control everything. Isn't that? Yeah. Isn't that? This is funny. Ego's version of enlightenment. The ultimate control. Isn't it? Isn't it? You know, when we think, what's going to make me everlastingly blissful? The ability to control everyone and everything so that it all becomes the way I want it to be. Yeah? That's kind of our notion of enlightenment. And yet, really, what we have to do to become enlightened is give up this clinging to control. You know? Give up this, you know, clinging to make everything the way we want it to be. Yeah? In the way that's comfortable for us. In a way that agrees with our ideas and our opinions and our social values and our political views and the way we think things should be done. You know? Because our mind has so many conceptions, you know, just so chock-a-block full of conceptions about how we want everything to be and what we think everything is. And it's all those conceptions that imprison us because we can't see beyond them. You know, everything is the way I want it to be, and if it isn't, then I've got to make it that way. Yeah? And so, you know, our mind becomes so inflexible, incredibly inflexible. And we can see it. You know, we had a little thing this week at the Abbey when I spoke to a few people about, you know, how when I was training, my teachers encouraged us to not sleep as much as we usually do. And to try and, you know, gradually, slowly, you know, reduce our sleep. Whoa! A little bit of resistance in that discussion. Yeah? Yeah? It was very interesting how it was like, all of a sudden, I'm threatened. I gotta hold on to my sleep, even though I'm not awake to enjoy it. I've gotta hold on to it. Yeah, or I've got to hold on to my idea of how much sleep I think I need. Yeah. You know, so this is just a little example. So there's, you know, there's so many things that when we hear the teachings, our mind just rebels. It's like, I don't want to hear that. I don't want to be told to do that. I want ultimate control. So, you know, I think, you know, when we say I want to become enlightened, we really need to think about what does that mean? What does that mean? Now, on what level do we want to become enlightened? Is it on the level of the mouth? Yeah? The level of the mouth is, you know, we can want a lot of things on the level of the mouth. You know, on the level of the heart, it's something else. Okay, so just this is something to work at and observe, you know, when we're cultivating our motivation. Because we know how to say all the right words. Yeah, we're very good at saying all the right words. But are we good at feeling the meaning of those words? Yeah. Are we, you know, how much do we really believe those words? Yeah. I mean, even when the Buddha says ignorance, anger, and attachment are hindrances to liberation and to happiness. Well, yeah, ignorance is, you know, a hindrance. If you don't vote for my political candidate, that's a hindrance to liberation. Yeah, and anger is a hindrance. All those other people out there should get rid of their anger. Yeah, their anger definitely hinders happiness in the world. My anger is justified and righteous and proper and suitable. But their anger is the kind that makes unnecessary conflict. Right? And attachment is a hindrance, you know, especially all those greedy people. But, you know, I'm not one of them. I'm very magnanimous, generous, and I will give everything for a small price, which is that my ego gets pleased in the process of it. Yeah. So really, even getting ourselves to think, will we really in our heart believe that anger is a hindrance? So that when anger comes up, the next thought that comes up is, there's a hindrance in my mind. Or to really believe that anger is inaccurate and unrealistic. So that when anger is in the mind, the next thought is, my mind is under the sway of afflictions. It's not seeing reality. It's an interesting thing. When we get angry, you know, is our next thought, my mind is afflicted? No. Next thought is, my mind is right. And I'm going to be victorious. And anger actually is easier to recognize as a hindrance, much easier than attachment. Because when there's attachment, we kind of feel good. So how can we say that is a hindrance? Because then we jump to another wrong conception, which is, oh, well, if attachment is a hindrance, then feeling good is a hindrance. Therefore, the path is all about suffering. So I better suffer. Because the more I suffer, the more compassionate I am. And we get so totally messed up, you know, about what does compassion mean. And we think, we really begin to think that if we're happy, that happiness and compassion are contradictory. And you can't have both. Okay? So in order to be really compassionate and really sacrifice your own selfishness, you have to be miserable. We have that in the back of our mind, don't we? You know, because if I'm happy, I'm kind of guilty. Yeah? You ever feel guilty about being happy? Like, I don't deserve to be happy. I'm happy, I'm selfish. I should be miserable, and then I can make sure that there's no attachment there. Yeah? That's nutty. That's totally nutty. Yeah? I mean, Buddha didn't teach the path of misery. That's not it at all. Buddha was teaching us how to be happy. Yeah? And so actually, as we practice, you know, the mind should become happier and more joyful as we come to really understand what are the causes of happiness and what are the causes of suffering. And seeing that ignorance and anger and attachment are the causes of suffering. And so therefore wanting to relinquish them instead of wanting to hold on to them. Okay. It's really, you know, there's a lot in this, in checking our motivation and in feeling the meaning of the words that we say. Okay, so last week we talked about the five faults of concentration, according to how they're spoken of in Asanga and Maitreya, and the eight antidotes. Okay, folks, time for a pop quiz. Okay, what are the five hindrances? The five faults.
Laziness.
Forgetting the object. Laxity and excitement. Not applying the antidote and over applying it. Yay. Now, what are the eight antidotes? How many antidotes are there to the first one?
Four.
What are they?
Faith.
Aspiration. Not yet. Yeah, effort. Then pliancy. Okay. And then the antidote for forgetting the instructions?
Mindfulness.
The antidotes for excitement and laxity? Introspection. Okay. The antidote for not applying the antidote?
Applying
the antidote. That one you all remembered. Okay. And then the antidote for over-applying it?
Equanimity.
Okay. Oh, you get there. Okay. Now let's go back when we were doing the five hindrances. What were the five hindrances? What?
Attachment to sense desires.
Ill will. Restless and worry. Sloth and torpor. And doubt. Okay. Good. Okay. So this time, we're going to go through the nine steps on the path to gain serenity, okay, or shamatha. Shamatha is the Sanskrit Pali word. Sometimes it's translated into English as calm abiding. I prefer serenity. The Tibetan is jine. Okay, so there's nine steps that are called the nine mental abidings. Nine abidings of the mind. Okay, so as we're progressing through these nine abidings, we do so by means of six powers. Okay, so six powers are hearing, yeah, and then reflection or thinking, mindfulness, introspection, effort, and complete familiarity. Okay. And then in addition, we go through these nine by means of four types of mental engagement. So four ways of engaging with our object of meditation. So the first one's called forceful. Second one is uninterrupted. No, I'm sorry. Second one is interrupted. Third one is uninterrupted. And fourth one is spontaneous. Okay, so forceful, interrupted, uninterrupted, and spontaneous. So these are ways of engaging with the object. Yeah, you'll come to see what they mean as we go through these nine. Okay, so I have to preference this explanation of the nine in that, you know, I've heard it at several different times, and the length of time that they say you need to be able to concentrate at some of these different levels differs in different explanations that I've heard. So I'm giving it according to one way. Yeah, but sometimes the length of time differs a little bit. Okay, so the first mental abiding, you know, when you're first beginning to you know, try and develop some serenity, the first step is called setting the mind. So this is learning to set or place the mind on the object of meditation. So at this stage, our goal is to find the focal object, to find the object of meditation, and place our mind on it, even though our mind can't stay on it very long. Okay? So the object appears, it isn't clear, the mind is full of discursive thoughts. Okay? So, and full of distraction. And in fact, sometimes at the very beginning of the practice, we think, you know, our mind's getting worse. We used to not be so distracted. And now we're trying to meditate, and our mind is just all over the place. So sometimes we get this idea of, oh, my mind's getting worse. Actually, it's not getting worse. It's just that we're noticing what's been there all the time. It's kind of like if you live in a house that's near the freeway, after a while you don't hear the cars. If you go away on vacation, then when you come back, you hear the cars. Okay? It isn't that your mind's getting worse or anything. It isn't that there's more cars out there. It's just that, you know, your perception has changed. You're able to notice it more. So here too, you know, when we start to meditate, it seems like our mind is just all over the place. Right? Yeah? So don't get discouraged at this point. Yeah? Don't say, oh, it's too much, my mind's distracted, I can't meditate, you know, I'm afraid to even try because it's just too hard. Kind of giving up before we even try, saying it's too hard, I think I'll just, you know, do something else. Yeah. Okay. But really, you know, don't pressure the mind, but don't give up on ourselves either. Okay? So, you know, we just keep on training and we keep on practicing these methods. And just even noticing how busy our mind is already a step in the right direction, because before we didn't even notice it. Yeah. Before, you know, probably we had no idea of all the weird thoughts that go through our mind. Did we? Yeah. We usually thought, oh, I'm a pretty good person, you know. I don't have any bad thoughts. Well, once in a while I get a little anger, but, you know, there's no violent thoughts. There's no resentful thoughts. There's no jealousy in my mind. I'm a really good person. Now, that's the way I thought before I started meditating, you know. And then you sit down and you just try and develop any little bit of concentration, and it's like, it's a horror show in there, isn't it? It's like the, you know, violent thoughts and lustful thoughts and resentful thoughts and cruel thoughts and greedy thoughts and everything in the book, you know. Yeah. And then we go, it's only me. Yeah, I'm the only one that has all these awful thoughts in my mind. Well, sorry. You know, there's two of us. You and me, at least. Okay? Yeah, but we really do. We get sometimes scared, like, how could I think of such things? It's terrible, you know. It's terrible what's going through my mind. You know, oh, I just better make it all go away. You know. So that makes us completely nutty, doesn't it? Yeah. So we even, you know, when it talks about forceful attention, that's not what it's talking about. Okay. But this is really where we sometimes get discouraged. We give up on ourselves. Or, you know, we just go to sleep. Yeah? Go to sleep. Go out and get a beer. Go out and smoke a joint. Turn on the TV. Go play a video game, because anyway, you're playing them in your mind. Okay? But, you know, don't do that. Just hang in there. Hang in there. I mean, we all go through the same things. It's not just you. Okay. So at this stage, we use the power of hearing, the first power, because we're trying to hear the instructions. Okay, and apply the instructions that we've heard. And we also use forceful engagement with the object in the sense that we have to, you know, put our mind on the object. We can't just, oh, there's the Buddha. Now what can I think of? Do you know that one? Yeah? It's like, you know, here's the refuge objects. Now I have to plan my day's activity. Right? You know? And you have your notice and you call the contractor, call the architect. Yeah, redesign the bathroom. Look up Rostra. Yeah. Okay. So that's why we need forceful engagement at the beginning, you know, to get the mind, you know, try and get the mind on the object. Okay? Call the printers, try and, you know, figure out who I'm calling today. Yeah, redesign the annual report. Yeah, okay. Okay, so that's the first stage. Then the second stage is called continuous setting. And here we can keep our mind on the object a little bit longer without being immediately distracted. Okay? But still, the time we spend on the object is far outweighed by the time we spend off the object. Okay? So our concentration is constantly interrupted by the scattering mind. Constantly interrupted. Okay? But still, it's a little bit better than it was on the first stage. So every so often, we get a little feeling of peace of mind in there. Okay? And so they say that we attain this stage when we can keep our mind kind of on the object for about 10 minutes. But like I've heard, that sounds long to me, you know? I've also heard other periods of time that's less. Okay, we'll take that version, won't we? Okay, so here it's still with forceful engagement, because we still need to try and pin the mind to the meditation object. But we're also here using the power of thinking or reflection, yeah, to contemplate the object again and again. Okay. Then the third mental abiding is called resetting. Yeah. They had these terms before the computers were invented, but resetting. Okay, so here, you still have distractions, but you notice them more quickly, and you can bring your mind back to the object of meditation more quickly. There's still distractions, you know, but previously we didn't recognize the distractions right away. We were in la-la land for, you know, a good period of time. Now we can recognize that the mind's gotten off. And so thus the scattering is much shorter in duration, and it becomes easier to return the mind to the object and to keep the mind there. Okay? And so here they say that we can stay on the object maybe two-thirds of the time. Yeah? And our meditation session is able to be longer.
Okay, so here the engagement is interrupted because our, you know, we can't just engage with the object continuously. It's interrupted by scattering, by negative thoughts, by, you know, all sorts of other things. So it's still interrupted engagement. But now our power of mindfulness is becoming much stronger because, you know, mindfulness is what helps us stay on the object and develop stability. And so that's coming, you know, we're beginning to develop some of that now. Then the fourth stage is called close setting. And here we're more familiar with the object. Okay, the mind's really becoming friends with the object. Doesn't feel so strange. Yeah, like, you know, imagining the Buddha, or let's say if the Buddha's your meditation object, it begins to feel quite natural and, you know, kind of like part of you. And so on this stage, you never completely lose the object, although sometimes one part of the mind might get distracted. Okay, but you're never off just totally in la-la land. Yeah, there's still some little tie to the object, even if you get distracted. So you still have gross excitement and gross laxity. So remember, gross excitement was when you totally lose the object. Yeah, so that sometimes happens, but not so much. And you have gross laxity, which is leading us into lethargy, you know, into the mind being dull. Okay, but the power of mindfulness is really becoming stronger here. Okay, so the power of mindfulness, you know, came to the forefront in the third. It's becoming stronger in the fourth. Then the fifth stage is called disciplined or tamed. Okay. And here the mind is more disciplined and more tamed. It can stay on the object continuously. So it's more or less single-pointed. It's not deep in single-pointedness, but it's more or less there. And previously, you know, somebody last week was asking about subtle laxity. Before this stage, before the fifth stage, subtle laxity isn't even a problem. Because you can't stay on the object long enough for it to be a problem. Okay? Then the mind wasn't single-pointed at all. So now when the mind's, you know, developing a little bit, you know, more ability to be on this one object, that's when the subtle laxity begins to become a problem. Okay? Because the clarity, the intensity of the clarity isn't very strong. Okay? And so actually with subtle laxity, the mind gets too absorbed in the object. You know, it gets so absorbed that, you know, somehow the intensity is lessening. Okay, so here the engagement is still interrupted by laxity and excitement, but the concentration can be more easily restored, and this is by the power of introspection. Okay, so introspection becomes more important on the fifth stage. Then the sixth stage is called pacifying. Okay, so in the previous stages, we tighten the mind sometimes to eliminate laxity, but on this sixth stage of pacifying, sometimes the concentration, the way the mind's holding the object, is too tight. Okay, so that's not very beneficial. And so the mind holds the object too tight, so the mind gets too happy, you know, some subtle kind of excitement is in there. There's, you know, this zing feeling a little bit too happy. But on the other hand, any dislike or any hesitation about single-pointedness has been abandoned. So you're really getting into the meditation, but maybe the mind's a little bit too excited, zingy, happiness, giddy. Okay? So subtle laxity may still come from time to time. Yeah? So you have both subtle laxity and subtle excitement. So the engagement is still interrupted by those two. But introspection is really strong, is gaining importance. Okay? So on the third and the fourth, mindfulness was, you know, really primary in terms of helping you to stabilize the mind. And here on the fifth and sixth, introspection, you know, is very important in terms of recognizing the laxity and the excitement. Then the seventh stage is called thorough pacifying. Okay. And so here, even if negative emotions or afflictions manifest in between meditation sessions, okay, you can still, you know, calm the mind down pretty quickly from them. And subtle laxity and subtle excitement arise occasionally, but they can't really damage the single-pointedness so much. Okay, so mind is gaining stronger single-pointedness. The subtle laxity excitement can come from time to time, but they can't be real, real damaging to your concentration. And so here, non-application of the antidotes becomes a problem. Okay? Because you're kind of getting more single-pointed, so you might, you know, just not apply the antidotes. Okay, so on the seventh one, although a laxity and excitement don't interrupt the concentration, due to the power of effort, so here the power of effort's really strong, still the engagement is called interrupted engagement because laxity and excitement are still there. They haven't been eradicated, you know. The gross one, the kind of ability to manifest in your meditation hasn't been eliminated. That's the seventh one. Okay, seventh one was called thorough pacifying. Yeah, then the eighth one is called making single-pointed. Yeah, and so here, when you sit down to meditate, you can immediately get your meditation object, and you only need to generate effort at the beginning of your meditation session. Okay? So you immediately get the object. You have to have some effort to get the mind into the meditation. But once you have that, then your mind can stay, fairly single-pointed for a good period of time. Okay. Okay, so that effort is needed at the beginning to discern the details of the object of meditation and to guard against laxity and excitement. Then once you get into the meditation, you don't need to exert a lot of forceful effort after that. Okay. And so here, at this point, introspection isn't so important because the mind, you know, is much more tamed and can stay on the object because laxity and excitement don't arise anymore. And it's at this point on the eighth stage that the engagement or the intention becomes uninterrupted. Okay? So the mind can stay on the object of meditation without, you know, faltering or skipping beats due to the factor of effort. Okay. Then the ninth mental abiding is called setting in equipoise. Okay? And so here, when you sit down to meditate, you just need the wish to meditate at the beginning of the session. You don't even have to exert any effort to find the object, to keep the mind on the object, to eliminate a laxity and excitement. Sounds nice, huh? But you get to the ninth one by starting at number one. Yeah, you have to go all the way up. You don't go to college when you're 5 years old. You go to kindergarten and progress your way up. So it's the same way. So at this point on the ninth level, the sense consciousnesses or the sense organs don't function so much. Yeah, and it seems that you don't really respond to external stimuli. So, you know, your legs don't hurt. The baby crying doesn't bother you. You don't smell the burnt toast anymore. Yeah, sounds nice, huh? Okay. So here, this is the power of familiarity, because the mind is so familiar with the object, it just immediately goes to it, and the engagement is spontaneous. Mm-hmm. Yeah? It's not forceful, it's not interrupted, it's not uninterrupted, it's just spontaneous. It's right there. Okay. Now, what's interesting in this is even at this ninth stage, that still is not serenity. That's not serenity yet. That's not shamatha yet. Okay? So, you know, definitely we're getting some benefits from our concentration, okay? In fact, they say that your complexion becomes younger. If you start looking more youthful, you don't need to eat as much. You know how they talk about, you know, when we make the offerings, how food represents samadhi, concentration? So it's the food of samadhi, you know. Your body, mind becomes nourished by samadhi. Okay? You still don't have total serenity yet. You're close. You don't have it yet. Okay? Your body feels much lighter and more vigorous. Yeah, more energetic. Okay. So if we just review the first the mental abidings, the first three, which are setting the mind, continuous setting, and resetting. Okay? Those three are to help us abide on the object of meditation, to get the mind on the object of meditation. Okay. The next three, close setting, disciplining, and pacifying, okay, those are to stabilize the mind that's already on the object. Okay, so by the first three, you get the mind on the object. And by the next three, you stabilize the mind. So, you know, on those three, you're really working a lot with attachment and laxity to be able to stabilize the mind on the object. Okay? And then the last three, thorough pacifying, making single-pointed, and setting an equipoise, then those three are the means to gain full control over the mind that has attained stability. Okay, so there you're really building on and you know, really subduing the mind very strongly in those last three. Okay, still not in serenity. Now we have to talk a little bit about different levels of mind, the different realms. Remember we talked before about there's the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm? Mm-hmm. Okay, so the desire beings and the desire realm, you know, hell beings, hungry ghosts, animals, human beings, and the desire realm gods, they're all very attached to sense objects. Okay, then form realm beings have a subtle kind of form, but they also have single-pointed concentration, okay, and deep states of samadhi. Those are the four jhanas, or meditative stabilizations. And then you have the formless realm, where the beings don't have any kind of, you know, gross body whatsoever, and they're really, you know, kind of on their object of meditation, and there's nothing else, zero, okay? So still at this point, on the ninth mental abiding, you still have a desire realm mind, okay? Mm-hmm. So, And it's not serenity. So you keep on practicing, and The next level you attain is called access concentration, or sometimes it's called neighboring concentration. So this is it's called access because it's what's right before the first meditative stabilization, the first jhana. It's what gives you access to the first jhana. Or it's called neighborhood concentration because you're in the neighborhood of the meditative stabilizations of the jhanas. Okay? So, but that access realm is, it's called the access, first meditative. That is a form realm mind. It's not a desire realm mind. Okay? So, the person, if you start out as a human being, the person is still a desire realm person, but when they attain this access concentration, their mind becomes a form realm mind. Okay? Okay, and then once you attain this access concentration, then you do 7 preparatory stages until you get to the full first meditative stabilization. There's different, you know, levels of preparatory stages where you are lessening, you know, your attachment to desire realm objects and really developing that form realm mind. And then that gives you the first meditative stabilization. You can meditate in that for a while. I'm going to come back and explain a little bit more about how to get to access, but just to give you the overview. Once you have that first, the first meditative stabilization, the first jhana, then, you know, you have, there's so many different ways of translating it. There's investigation and analysis. Sometimes it's translated as initial application and sustained application. Then there's rapture. There's sukha is bliss, and then one-pointedness. Okay, so you have those 5 qualities in the first one, and you meditate in the first jhana for a while, but then after a while you begin to see that it's still a little bit gross because you still have this investigation and analysis, or the initial application, sustained application. So you start seeing the faults of the first meditative stabilization, and you start seeing the benefits of gaining the second one, and then you start aspiring to attain the second one, and you keep practicing and deepening your concentration. And so you go through 7 preparatory stages here too until you get to the second one. Okay? Then you meditate and you master the second one, and then at a certain point, you begin to see the second one is a little bit gross because it has rapture. And so then you go through 7 more preparatory stages of lessening, you know, of seeing the faults of the second one and the benefits of the third meditative stabilization, deepening your concentration, and then you go into the third meditative stabilization. Okay, and then the same process repeats for the fourth, seeing the disadvantages of the third, the benefits of the fourth, deepening the concentration. In this case, it's letting go of even the bliss, and then, you know, really going into one-pointedness at that point. Okay, so that's where you go through the 4 jhanas, and then you can even go higher beyond that into the 4 formless absorptions. Okay, but what's very interesting is that in order to meditate on special insight or vipassana, you know, to develop that, you can do that with just the access concentration. You don't need to have attained the jhanas. In one explanation, and I have a quote from Lama Tsongkhapa that says that, but then I also have some notes later that say that to Well, let me read you Jay Rinpoche's quote, okay? Jay Rinpoche says, this is in the Lamrim Chenmo. He says, furthermore, even if you do not achieve the higher meditative stabilizations of the form realm or meditative absorptions of the formless realm, but do achieve the serenity explained previously, which is included in the level of access to the first meditative stabilization, then you can achieve liberation, freedom from all the fetters of cyclic existence, by cultivating special insight based on that serenity. Okay? But then, I have something later on that says that to enter the path of accumulation of any of the three vehicles, here, solitary realizer or bodhisattva, that you need at least the first jhana. Okay? What I find interesting, you know, is because I've been studying also sometimes the Theravada presentation of this, there seems to be the same kind of ambiguity there too. Mm. You know? It's like, you know, that you don't even need the first jhana to attain liberation. But then when you look at it, to become a non-returner, you know, you stream entry, not once returner, non-returner. To become a non-returner, then it seems like you would at least need the first jhana, because a non-returner never returns to the desire realm. So at least you would think that person should have, you know, a mind that is in the form, you know, definitely established in the form realm and has given up attachment to sensual desire. So there seems to be this kind of ambiguity. So maybe what we need to do is practice and see from our own experience. Yeah?
Homework?
Yes, that's your homework. Okay? That's your homework.
Is it the same level?
Huh?
Is it at the same level where they have the, between access and first jhana, where they actually do both the Theravada presentation?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it seems to be, you know, kind of right between the access and the first jhana. Because the access, you've suppressed the five hindrances, you know, the one, the sensual desire, and that set of hindrances. But you haven't clearly yet have the force of the initial application, sustained application, rapture, bliss and one-pointedness. Okay? Now, let's go back. That's just like an over thing of what's to come. But let's go back and see when you're on the ninth level of mental abiding, what you have to do to get to access. Okay? Because there's still some work here. Okay? So, so you're on the ninth mental abiding, yeah? So you still have to attain mental and physical pliancy and physical and mental bliss. And it's done in that order. Mental pliancy, physical bliss, and then mental bliss. Okay? So this is what happens, okay? And some people are able to go through this and get to the access quickly, and some people, it takes them some time to do it. Everybody's a little bit different. Okay, so you're very familiar with your object of meditation. You keep on meditating. Okay, and so then any undesirable physical conditions that are related to the winds, to your lung, the wind energy winds in the body, so this becomes... Oh, this gets overcome, and you get a sense of bliss and a pleasant tingling sensation at your head. Okay, now everybody's tomorrow is going to say, oh, I got a tingling sensation. Maybe I'm on the verge. Okay. Well, first check if you've done the first nine, okay, before you get too excited about tingling on your head. Okay, so... you get the tingling because these very gross winds, you know, that are very agitated are starting to leave, okay? And then immediately after that, all undesirable mental states that are related to these restless kind of unsurfaceable winds, they calm down, so the mind no longer is unserviceable or resistant to focusing on virtuous objects. And at this point, you have mental pliancy. Okay? So the mind becomes very flexible, very pliant. All your resistance to virtuous objects has, been suppressed. So there's mental pliancy, which is a mental factor. Okay? Okay, and it's mental pliancy is a mental factor that enables the mind to be directed towards a virtuous object, and it accompanies all virtuous minds. However, here it's a special mental pliancy because it's a lightness and a clarity of mind coupled with the mind's ability to focus on any virtuous object it wants. Okay, so the mind's very serviceable. It's light, it's clear, it's not resistant to focusing on virtue. You can put the mind somewhere and it's just content to stay on that virtuous object. Very pliant. Yeah, no resistance. Okay, so then that's the mental pliancy. Okay, so then this mental pliancy induces serviceability or pliancy of the winds in the body, so the rest of the winds in the body, because the winds that lie behind the afflictions begin to subside and, mellow out a little bit. And so instead you get a wind of physical pliancy. Yeah, so this starts to pervade the whole body. And at this point, the body can be used for whatever virtuous purposes you want. Yeah? So the body feels as light as cotton. And they say that a meditator feels like he or she can ride on his or her own shoulders. That's how light you feel. Okay? You know how sometimes you see you've seen the diagram with the elephant and the monkey and the monk and, mm-hmm. Yeah? So here you're getting to the point where, you've seen that diagram? Oh, yeah, we'll have to show it to you. You know, that shows how all these stages, these nine stages, go. So here, the meditator's starting to, kind of go off in the sky a little bit. So there's physical pliancy. So the mind can, mental pliancy, the mind can go on the virtuous object. Physical pliancy, you don't have any obstacles with your body. Okay? And so this leads to the experience of the bliss of physical pliancy. Okay? And so that is an actual object of touch. Yeah, the bliss of physical. It's a blissful object of touch because you feel it in your body, with your tactile consciousness. So it's an object of touch. Yeah. So as the samadhi continues, then the practitioner has a sense that their body melts into the meditation object. And it's at this point that the bliss of mental pliancy is experienced. Okay, so the mind is very joyful. You feel like you can focus on every atom in a wall. Yeah, and then after that, you have a sensation on the top of your head that they say is similar, after you've shaved your head, to placing a cool palm on the top of a freshly shaven head. Those of you who have shaved your head, you know what that feels like. A certain coolness, yeah. So they say it's like that. The mental bliss decreases just a little bit, so that it becomes stable, yeah. And you get an unchangeable bliss of concentration, and an unchangeable mental pliancy. And at that point, that you have serenity. Mm-hmm. Okay? So it's at that point you have serenity. And so that is the, You know, it's a single point of concentration conjoined with physical and mental pliancy. And the stabilizing meditation has been brought to fulfillment. Okay, so there's many signs of having attained serenity. So, you know, like we talked about before, the mind is pliant, the body, you know, doesn't have aches and pains and can do things. Even loud sounds don't interfere with your meditation. You know, you're not distracted by them. There's a very strong sense of clarity, like the mind could count the atoms in the wall. Your negative emotions are not there in the meditative sessions at all. And in between sessions, they're also much weaker, because by the power of being in samadhi, you know, you're lessening the familiarity with those and increasing the familiarity with a peaceful mind. So then in the meditation session, in the break time between sessions, you know, the mind is more calm because it's not afflicted by all these things. Okay? You're then free, you know, from the five hindrances, you know, the sensual desire and ill will, that set. You haven't eliminated them completely because you haven't gained insight into emptiness yet. But they're suppressed. Okay? So there's different levels of eliminating afflictions. You know, at our level, we're applying the antidotes, like an opposite state of mind very often, that enables us to let go of that mental affliction when it's in our mind. Okay? Then after that, you go to the level of suppressing the afflictions. So that happens when you attain serenity. Yeah, the afflictions are suppressed. Not in the psychological sense of suppressed, you know, because psychological sense kind of has a bad implication. But here it's a good implication. Yeah, they've been suppressed in the sense that they aren't manifest. And they're suppressed by this extremely tranquil mind. Yeah. And in fact, you know, I think they say that many of the meditators who attain this, when they need to rest, they just go into samadhi. Because the mind's so peaceful and tranquil, that's how you rest. Okay. And then the third level of eliminating the afflictions is actually cutting them off at the root. And this occurs only with vipassana, with the special insight focused on emptiness. Okay? So that's what we need to, you know, completely eliminate the afflictions from the mind. Okay, and actually, I think that's good enough. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that serenity is the preparation, is the access for the first meditative stabilization of the form realm. And so, like I said before, the person is in the desire realm, you know, the meditator at that point is, but their mind state is in the formless realm. And here is why it's really important that you meditate on emptiness, because if you, you know, don't have strong renunciation from samsara, and you know, then you don't meditate on emptiness. You don't wish to renounce the bliss of these meditative states. So then in your next lifetime, you get born in, you know, if you die with a virtuous thought and this unwavering karma ripens, then you get born in that level of form realm or formless realm absorption that corresponds to the level that you attained as a human being. Okay, so, you know, attaining, that's why we say that attaining, you know, samadhi or the meditative stabilization, it's not a uniquely Buddhist attainment. Yeah, but this is exactly why, you know, training the mind and the determination to be free and the wish for liberation is so important, because otherwise it's, first of all, easy to maintain, to mistake this blissful state of samadhi for liberation, especially as you get deeper and deeper and deeper into the form and formless realm, you know, absorptions. then it's just so blissful. You never come out of your meditation. You think that you're liberated, and then when you die, you know, you realize you aren't, and then poof, it's a mess. Okay? So, you know, that's why our teachers don't send us into meditation to develop concentration right away. That's why they all encourage us to really understand what samsara is and to really develop some degree of renunciation so that even when we attain this kind of concentration, we don't get stuck in it. But still we want to go further and be free of all of cyclic existence. And so that propels us to, you know, meditate on special insight and realize emptiness directly.